Up next, we have our book reading program, Ohomoni Iyotaka, read by Gail Hubling.
The Lakota Way, Stories and Lessons for Living by Joseph M. Marshall III. Chapter 6, Sacrifice. Each upi, to give of oneself an offering. The Story of the Thunders. In the old days, some men took more than one wife. We wonder today what that might be like to have more than one wife. Sometimes we laugh about it, and some of us deep down could be a little envious. Back then, however, when a man had more than one wife, it meant that he had to work harder. He had to provide more food, more meat, and more animal hides for clothing. So he had to hunt more. And if children came, well, then he had to work that much harder. The excitement of having more than one wife was not all there was to it. Most of the time it was for a practical reason, like when a man would take the wife of a friend who was killed in battle. Or he would marry the younger sister of his wife because the first wife wanted it that way. Sometimes things went smoothly, sometimes they did not. Such was the case with a certain woman in the time before the horses came. The people had moved into the open country. Across what we call the plains, there were many scattered encampments from the Great Muddy River, west as far as the Black Hills, south through the Running Water River, and north to the Knife River. Some were as close as 1 or 2 days of travel, and others were many, many days apart. In one village just east of the Black Hills, there was a woman named Shinaluta, or Redshaw. She had married a man who was a good provider and had a good reputation. No children were born to them for many years. Then she bore a son. So she was surprised when her husband announced that he would take a second, younger wife. An old man and woman in another village had raised their granddaughter after both her parents had frozen to death in the blizzard. They were getting on in years and wanted to see their granddaughter, Necklace, married to a good man, so they approached White Wing, Redshaw's husband, and he had agreed. Redshaw never once thought that she would have to share her husband with another woman. Although as first wife, the sits-beside-him wife, she would be able to say how her lodge should be cared for. She was still jealous. When White Wing left to bring home the new wife, Redshaw packed a few belongings and the bows and arrows he had made for her and stole away in the night. She tossed scraps of meat to the camp dogs so they wouldn't bark and alert the night sentinels posted around the encampment. She told no one of her plan. So when her lodge door stayed shut for several days, the people suspected she had left but didn't know where she might have gone. Some had seen such things before. A first wife moving out because of jealousy. Redshaw traveled east, intending to stay with a cousin who was part of a band living just west of the Great Muddy River. That village meant many, many days of travel, but like all Lakota women of her day, Redshaw was strong and resourceful. She knew how to hunt, how to be watchful of enemies, and how to pitch a safe hidden night camp. She could not travel fast because she was carrying her weapons, a large rawhide case filled with food, and her infant son in his cradle board. He wasn't heavy, but he did need to suckle her breasts, so she would have to stop often to feed him. After a few days' travel, she decided to make camp for a day, mainly to rest her tired feet. Between the sheltering branches of two buffalo berry thickets high on a slope, she made a cozy camp and spent the day playing with her son. She was still confused over her husband's marriage to a second wife, and her heart was broken, but she tried not to think about that. In the afternoon, a warm breeze sang them both to sleep. Toward sundown, a deep rumble of thunder woke her, and Redshaw saw that dark gray storm clouds had taken away the blue sky. Lightning flashed within the thick folded clouds and turned the breezes into angry gusting winds that suddenly bent the buffalo berry thickets and shook them about. Redshaw gathered her things and decided to look for better shelter from the rain she knew would come. She remembered a low thicket of chokecherry not far away and hurried toward it. A summer thunderstorm is the most powerful of the beings that live above the prairie country, second only to the great twisting winds that can uproot great trees and fill the skies with their terrible blackness. Redshaw had never seen such a wind, but was fearful that she might She had to bend into the gusts to keep from falling and turn away from the wind as leaves stung her face. She covered her baby's cradle board as small branches flew like arrows and dust stung her eyes. An angry gust tore her food pack away from her and tossed it a long stone's throw, nearly pulling the cradle board away too. She crawled the last few paces to a low thicket, covering her baby with her body to protect him from the wind that was now a steady roar in her ears. Her food gone, her weapons lost, she pushed into the thicket and curled up in a ball with her back to the wind. Then came wind-driven heavy cold drops that felt like pebbles when they hit bare skin, and with them came a sudden darkness. The red shawl could do nothing but huddle over her baby to shield him from the storm. The rain turned into a cloudburst, drenching the land. She was soaked to her skin, and her deer-hide dress was cold and heavy. Little by little, the wind slowed, but the rain kept pounding the land. Tiny streams of water coursed around them, and Redshawl had to lift the cradleboard off the grass to keep her baby as dry as possible. Wiping the water out of her eyes, she tried to look around for a high spot, a hill or a knoll, knowing the safest place for them was high ground. Redshawl had never been alone in bad weather. In the past, when the winter blizzard soared over the land, she was safe in her mother and father's lodge. When a spring and summer windstorm suddenly fell upon them, everyone in the encampment pounded down the thicket. Tight and closed their lodge doors. If there was danger, it didn't seem as bad because many people were around. Now, as the cold rain pelted her face, Redshawl suddenly understood what it meant to be truly alone. She was alone in a dark land that existed only as far as she could see. She hung on tight to the cradleboard and headed for the south side of a long gully, hoping to climb its ridge and find some shelter, any shelter. Slipping and sliding in the mud slowed her down, so she stopped to rest in the lee side of a sturdy cottonwood tree. The rain kept coming down heavier and heavier until every low area was running with water. A soft whimper reminded her that her breast was full, and it was time to feed the baby. Turning away from the rain as much as she could, she opened the covering of the cradle board and fed the hungry baby. For a few moments, she forgot about the rain as she enjoyed the closeness she felt with her baby. He was so hungry he quickly drained her breast, so she switched him to the other. Resting against the tree, Redshawl shivered in her wet clothes, thankful that she had managed to keep the baby as dry as possible. The sudden storm had shaken her up, reminding her that life was a journey full of the unexpected, like a second wife for her husband. She knew his reason for taking the second wife was not to replace her, but to provide a place for someone who would need a provider and protector. Redshawl looked at her son, at his trusting eyes. Her fit of girlish jealousy had placed him in danger. She felt small and foolish. When the storm passed, she would head home, she decided. The wind had taken away her food and weapons, and it would be beyond foolish to continue her journey. Perhaps, she thought, the wind was trying to teach her a lesson. Redshawl drew her son close and then heard a low rumbling noise. A strange kind of thunder seemed to roll down from the sky. Then she realized it was not thunder from the clouds or the wind. It was a flash flood rolling down a deep gully, the gully she was in. Redshawl had never in her life seen anything like the mass of dark rolling water rushing toward her. Broken tree branches rolled with the churning water, reaching up and out like hands wanting to pull her in. It was no use to run, she knew. The rolling water would sweep them away. She forced herself to look away from the approaching death and somehow looked up to the fork of the sturdy cottonwood, but there was no time to climb. She stood and reached up as high as she could and jammed the cradleboard into the fork of the tree. Tying the straps around the fork, she prayed even as she wept, "Grandfather, take me if you must, but spare my son." The cold water grabbed her legs and pulled her into its churning black current. Redshawl awoke in cold and blackness, yet her body seemed hot with pain as she coughed and coughed. After painfully pulling herself into a sitting position, she realized she was caught in sandbar willows. She was somewhere near a river or a creek, she thought, because sandbar willows only grew along stream banks. Then she heard the gurgling voice of flowing water. Remembering the flood, she tried to jump to her feet, A hot, stabbing pain in her ankle stopped her, and she had to lean back until the pain passed. In the blackness of the night sky above, she saw stars. The storm had passed. Shivering, she tried to remember everything, but the only picture in her mind was a churning wall of dark, murky water. Except for the cold night air, the pain in her ankle, and the fullness in her breath, she was without feeling or memories. Then her heart seemed to stop. Her breasts were full, ready to be suckled. Her baby! Where was her baby? Memories of the day past swept her away, throwing her down into a dark hole of despair. She had lived through the flash flood, but she had lost her baby. Redshaw curled up in the cold, wet mud and wept. The pain on her ankle was nothing compared to the searing grief in her heart. She tore at her hair and clothes as her pain cried out from the pit of her being. Then she pounded the mud until her fists were numb. Slowly, then, a clear memory of the flood began to push itself into her mind, like the sun chasing away a storm cloud. Redshaw remembered the sturdy cottonwood tree. She remembered putting the cradle board in the fork and tying it fast. She wept again, but this time in hope. Perhaps the flood hadn't taken her baby. Perhaps the cottonwood had been strong enough to stand in the churning current. Ignoring the pain in her ankle, she rose and staggered around in the darkness. There was only one thing to do. Find that tree. Though the sky was filled with stars, there was no moon. As her mind began to clear, she could hear coyotes barking all around her, then wolves howling far away. There were other things in the darkness that were far more dangerous than coyotes or wolves. Bears were known to maim and kill two-leggeds, likewise the great cat, all the more reason to find her baby. Redshaw heard the birds beginning to awaken, then noticed a pale glow over a horizon. Dawn was approaching. That meant she had been knocked out for most of the night, and she wondered how far the flood had carried her. Slowly, slowly, the light grew and shadows took the shape of hills and trees. Waiting was difficult, but she knew it would be better to be patient until there was more light. She was glad to know which way was east. Light gave her a chance to look at her injured ankle. It was badly sprained, though she couldn't remember how. Somewhere in the lazy distance, she heard the bellow of a bull buffalo and the trilling call of a red-winged blackbird's morning song. Life started new each day, and Redshaw prayed that her baby was somewhere alive. Hawks took to the sky and soared on the cool morning breezes. A river was close because the valley was full of trees and the mist from its waters hung above them, but she couldn't recognize the land. She was far from home, though like all Lakota, she was a good traveler, always looking at her back trail, something she had been taught as a girl. She would have recognized country she had passed through. Immediately she looked around for the slope with the sturdy cottonwood, hoping that she had not been swept far from that, but she could see nothing familiar. As the first rays of the new sun hit her face, she stood and turned west. There were some realities in her favor. The storm had come from the west, and the cottonwood tree in which she had put her baby had been on the east-facing slope. The flood had come from the west and had swept her downslope to the east toward the river. Behind her, the river was flowing north. She could have been swept into it somewhere to the south, to her left, and carried along by its flood-swollen current to where she had awakened. Rethinking all of this, she turned her limping steps to the south. Redshaw ignored the hunger in her stomach. A gentle morning breeze chilled her but helped to dry out her dress. She was barefoot and bare-legged, her moccasins and leggings taken by the flood. Grabbing a broken branch, she used it as a walking stick. She kept a steady pace, knowing she couldn't walk fast with her injured ankle. At mid-morning, she stopped at a cool spring and drank its clear water. The day was warming and it gave her renewed hope. Close to midday, she paused to rest her ankle and realized she had reached the gully that had been flooded. Great piles of broken branches and flattened grass silently told the story of yesterday's flash flood. She gasped as she recognized the sturdy cottonwood. Ignoring her throbbing ankle, she tried to run, but even as she drew near to the tree, she saw that its branches held no cradleboard. Perhaps, she tried to reason, this isn't the tree. But the torn-up gully could not be mistaken. She reached the tree and knew she had been here. She knew that she had placed her son in the right fork and tied his cradleboard to it. There was nothing here. Redshaw fell to the ground and wept. If only she had stayed home. If only she had not gotten angry over her husband's second wife. Wiping away her tears, she stood and followed the path of the flood. looking for the cradle board with her son in it. The path of destruction was easy to follow. She had been swept along here, and she wondered how it was that she was still alive. At the river's edge, she turned and followed it north. When the sun was low in the western sky, she had returned to the spot she had awakened. She had not eaten and had taken water only once, but she didn't care. She wanted to die. Like the day before, clouds rimmed over the western horizon, but this day they were white and billowy, not low and dark. Resting against a small oak, Red Shawl wept quietly. "You who live in the clouds," she prayed, "take pity on my son. He is so small and helpless. Take his spirit up to Grandfather, and if you would be so kind, I want to be with my son." Red Shawl cried herself to sleep. She awoke just after sundown to a strange feeling in her full breast, reminding her of her mind-numbing loss. Night was coming as she wept again, great sobs shaking her body. Mercifully, the weariness of her body, weak from hunger, dragged her into sleep. A frightening dream of dark, swirling water woke her sometime in the night. To the west was a distant rumble of thunder and flashes of lightning. She immediately recalled her situation and fell into despair, knowing that she had failed as a mother and a wife. "You who live in the clouds," she prayed once again as thunder rolled beyond the horizon, "be kind to my son. Take him where it is safe." She thought that she would never be remembered as a good woman, but as a foolish and jealous one who caused the death of her own son. In her mind, she could see him, his dark eyes looking up at her with trust. It was all that she would ever have of him. The honorable thing to do was to go back to the village, she thought, and tell White Wing that her foolishness had killed their son. Even if he were to forgive her, she would never forgive herself. Though he was a good man, Red Shawl knew it was not likely that White Wing would welcome her back. It would be more likely that she would be banished from the village and forced to wander alone for the rest of her life. Once more, the soft, round little face of her son appeared in her mind. She could hear his soft voice, too. Perhaps that's what grief did to someone, she thought as she wept quietly. When she finally calmed herself, she heard the soft voice again. In her despair, she reached out and touched something in the darkness. Lightning flashed, and in that instant of light, she saw the cradle board and heard her son cry out in hunger. Disbelief tormented her. She expected the image of her son to fade away in the next heartbeat, but it didn't. Instead, he cried out again. With a shout of joy, she grabbed the cradle board and breathed on his tiny face. He was there. Red Shawl's joy knew no bounds. "Thank you, Grandfather," she cried. "Thank you, who live in the clouds." She unwrapped him from the cradle board and fed him. He eagerly suckled her breast, filling what seemed his bottomless hunger. Then she took him into the water and they bathed together. They slept on a grassy slope, caressed by a warm breeze. In the light of a new day, they began their journey home. Sometime on the second day, White Wing appeared and Red Shawl was overjoyed yet again. From their appearance, he could tell his wife and son had been through a difficult time. He made camp and saw to their comfort. "I have decided to take Necklace back to her grandparents," he said. "There are many good men who could take her for a wife." "No," said Red Shawl, "that would bring her shame. I will welcome her into our lodge because I will always be honored to be your first wife." Then she told him about the flood and that their son had been lost and then returned by the thunders. Though she never questioned why her son had been returned, for the rest of her life, Red Shawl wondered how it had happened. It was a joyful mystery and a reality that was sometimes hard to believe. One that she looked upon as a gift. To show gratitude for such a gift, she knew she had to give of herself in return. So Red Shawl took her rightful place as White Wing's first wife and welcomed Necklace as she would a sister. In time, they became close, and both were known far and wide as selfless and devoted mothers. Red Shawl's son grew tall and strong, was devoted to his mother. When he was 15, White Wing bestowed on the boy the name his father had given him. For the rest of his life, he was known as Wakia Aglipi, brought back by the thunders. Red Shawl lived a long life and was regarded by many as a good, wise woman. When someone would praise her, For her wisdom, she would thank them and quietly tell the story of how her son came by his name, and how even foolishness can lead to wisdom. Those who knew her would listen to in the spring and summer, especially when the thunders rumbled and lightning flashed inside the great rolling clouds. They would listen as she stood outside her lodge singing an honor song for those who lived in the clouds. The Gift of Self. A creation story describes our people coming up into the world through a hole in the earth. One person remained behind. Those who came out liked this place of light and warmth and decided to stay. It was obviously the right decision because the people wanted for nothing. Everyone was happy until hard times came. Drought laid waste to the land and famine came thereafter. The people became weak and began to die. The one who had stayed behind saw what was happening to those who had left and was sad to see them suffering. That last one came out of the hole and became the bison, the tatanka, the motopop, and multiplied until they covered the earth. The people hunted the bison and ate its flesh and were saved. As time went on, the people saw other ways to use the bison. From its hide, they made coverings for their dwellings. From its bones, they made toys and weapons. From its hair, they made rope. And from its horns, they made spoons and cups. Every part of the bison was put to use. The people became strong again. In fact, they grew stronger than they were before. For that, they honored the sacrifice of the bison in their songs and dances. In June of 1876, 8 days before the Battle of the Little Bighorn, somewhere between 700 to 900 Lakota and Shayela, Northern Cheyenne warriors, led by Crazy Horse, met General George Crook's 1,300-man column at Rosebud Creek, some 50 miles south of the Little Bighorn, and fought them to a standstill in a day-long battle. During the fighting, a prominent Shayela war leader was unhorsed within mere yards of the enemy's position. As he sought to escape on foot, a rider broke from the Shayela ranks, rode through intense enemy gunfire, and rescued the Shayela leader. The rider was a woman named Buffalo Calf Road, and she risked her life to rescue her brother. 11 months after the Lakota victory at the Battle of the Little Bighorn, the Ogallala Lakota leader Crazy Horse made a fateful decision. He decided to surrender to the United States government. Of his 900 followers, less than 130 were fighting men. The rest were the elderly and women and children. It was for the best interests of the latter group that Crazy Horse made his decision. The army had intensified its campaign against the Lakota after the humiliating defeat at the Little Bighorn, and Crazy Horse's biggest problem was one of numbers. His fighting men were badly outnumbered by the soldiers. The loss of even one Lakota fighting man meant a significant loss of protection for the non-combatants, not to mention that a family would lose a father or a son. Unlike the Americans, the Lakota and other Plains tribes did not have a standing army apart from the rest of the community. There were times when groups of fighting men, popularly called war parties, took to the field for patrol and reconnaissance duties for days and sometimes weeks. But they always returned to the encampment or village where their families were. Non-combatants were rarely left totally unprotected. Therefore, the males of fighting age did more than fight. Most of them were also husbands, fathers, hunters, horse trainers, teachers, and so on. In his military persona, the average Lakota fighting man, the warrior, was a formidable guerrilla fighter. And man for man, he became better. In his military persona, the average Lakota fighting man, the warrior, was a formidable guerrilla fighter, and man for man, he was better trained for fighting than the average cavalry or infantry soldier. For those reasons, there was talk among the Crazy Horse warriors of hiding their non-combatants and taking to the field, as a highly mobile, superb cavalry they were. But the logistical problem of finding a safe hiding place for the elderly and the women and children and ensuring that they had adequate provisions could not be solved. Even if that were possible, the older, more experienced warriors were certain that the army would find the helpless ones and attack them once they knew they had no effective protection. Their propensity for doing that was well known. General William Harney had attacked Isichavo Lakota camp in 1855 while most of the men were away hunting. Harney's soldiers killed women and children, and he was thereafter dubbed Woman Killer by the Sichavo. In 1868, the 7th Cavalry attacked a peaceful Cheyenne village at the Washita River in Kansas, and most of the casualties were women and children. And of course, the bitterest memory of all was the Shivington. And of course, the bitterest memory of all was Shivington's massacre of Cheyenne women and children at Sand Creek, Colorado, in 1864. As a 15-year-old boy, Crazy Horse had seen the aftermath of Harney attack. And that was the basis for his lifelong mistrust of the whites. Crazy Horse and others could see what lay ahead. Further resistance meant certain death for everyone because the whites were much too numerous. Indeed, he didn't know how right he was. In the late 1870s, the total population of all the Plains tribes, about 40 tribes from south to north, was probably between 250,000 to 300,000. The population of the United States was 25 million. The Lakota had dwindled to less than 15,000, and most of them were already on reservations. So the decision was made to surrender, and 900 people sacrificed their freedom for an uncertain future. Crazy Horse already knew all about such sacrifices. His Sichavu Lakota uncle, Spotted Tail, a formidable warrior in his own right and leader among the Sichavu as a young man, had surrendered himself to the soldiers in 1855. He took another man's place to be punished for an offense against the whites he didn't commit. Spotted Tail and a few other Sichavu men, along with their families, were taken to Fort Leavenworth, Kansas, to be imprisoned. Spotted Tail's relatives mourned for him because none of the Lakota who had been taken to Fort Leavenworth before had ever returned. But Spotted Tail did return, and with a newfound respect for the whites, not because they were a good people, but because there were too many of them. The same lesson Crazy Horse learned 22 years later. Life demands much from us. We are all called upon to make sacrifices for ourselves and more often for others. And sacrifice comes in many forms. Cemeteries all over the world are full of people who have made the ultimate sacrifice in the name of duty, patriotism, or ideology. We will never know how many fighting men from all of the Indian tribes died trying to protect their homelands and their way of life against white invasion. Wars and other cataclysmic events will always give rise to heroes, but life, thankfully, is quite ordinary for many of us. We may not wake up to a war in our residential neighborhood or find ourselves caught up in social or political upheaval, but some measure of sacrifice is often necessary nonetheless, such as parents working two jobs to enable their children's dreams, whether it's a college education or a pair of Nikes for basketball. The list is endless, and most parents put forth their efforts without complaint. These acts or deeds of sacrifice are the gift of self. The gift of self is the most meaningful anyone can give. A rich man who writes a check to a hospital to build a new research facility is certainly an epitome of generosity. Generosity is a necessary virtue, but unless that man has given away all of his money, he has not performed. Generosity is a necessary virtue, but unless that man has given away all of his money, he has not performed an act of sacrifice. A man had a wife and a daughter. He worked long and hard at his job and never failed to give them all they wanted and needed materially. The girl's room was full of expensive toys, and she wore the latest fashionable clothes. One evening, he happened to visit his daughter in her room and was puzzled to see the array of expensive toys languishing at the back of the room. Next to the girl's bed at eye level was a scrap of paper, a handwritten note pinned to the wall. The man recognized his own handwriting. It was a note he had hurriedly written because he had... The man recognized his own handwriting. It was a note he had hurried... It was a note he had hurriedly written because he couldn't attend her birthday party. It read, "My apologies, love, Dad." The expensive gift of jewelry he had left with the note was nowhere to be seen. "Why?" he asked his daughter. is this worthless piece of paper hanging on the wall? Because, his daughter replied, it's the only thing I have that is really from you. The most sacred of Lakota spiritual practices is the Wiwayan Wachipi, or looking at the sun and dancing, more popularly known as the sun dance. For non-Indians, it is probably the most intriguing and most misunderstood. Most non-Indians are appalled or turned off by what they describe as self-torture, the skin piercing that some participants must endure. The piercing is done to male dancers who have pledged to perform the dance. The skin of the upper chest, the pectoral region, is pierced in two places, and skewers made of bone are inserted. To the skewers is attached a cord that is tied to a central pole. The participants pull the cord tight as they dance, the object being to tear the skewers through the flesh. Other participants may be skewered through the skin on their backs, and they pull several buffalo skulls as they dance. The United States government, at the urging of many Christian churches that characterized the dance as uncivilized and barbaric, outlawed the sun dance. They failed or chose not to see the ceremony for what it was, a symbolic act of sacrifice. The sun dance is still with us because it demonstrates to us that sacrifice must be a genuine and operative virtue in our culture. The sun dancer gives of himself in spite of the terrible pain of being pierced and having skewers tear through his flesh. One obviously doesn't endure such pain for frivolous reasons. Participation may be an act of thanksgiving, for example, but it is always real and symbolic and reminds us that sacrifice, no matter how painful, is often necessary. To perform the sun dance is to truly give or offer the one gift that is most meaningful, the gift of self, which is all any of us truly has to give. I can recall my grandfather doing laundry for my uncle when he was in college. She would be the first to say that it was all part of her job. My uncle was at the University of South Dakota, some 250 miles away. He sent his laundry home by parcel post in a suitcase. Grandma would wash it by hand in a galvanized tub with the washboard, hang everything up to dry on the outdoor line, and then do the ironing. If the wind and the sun cooperated, it was a day's chore. I can remember her ironing those white shirts by lamplight late at night. She would meticulously fold them and repack them in the suitcase, which then meant that Grandpa and I would haul the suitcase by a team and wagon to the rural mailbox on the highway. As I recall, this happened on a regularly bi-weekly schedule. I know without a doubt that my uncle appreciated those efforts because there weren't many laundromats on campus in those days. Sending the laundry home proved to be a labor-intense process because we had no electricity in the late 1940s. Water had to be heated on the wood stove. The laundry hung on an outdoor line and then taken down, and the heavy iron heated on the stove. I'll always have this point of reference for the phrase, doing the laundry. My grandparents made plenty of sacrifices for me as well. For reasons that are still unclear to me, I must have changed schools at least a dozen times before I graduated from high school. My grandparents moved to be near me a few times. More than a few times, my grandmother did my laundry, sewed on buttons, darned socks, and so on. I appreciated those chores she did, but I know she thought of them as nothing more than little labors of love within the job description of a grandmother. There were hundreds of those little chores, perhaps thousands, that she performed for me and my siblings. I still appreciate them, not because of a patch on a pair of trousers or a freshly ironed shirt, but because of the lesson that came with them. She taught me how to give of myself. Sacrifices came in all sizes and for every reason under the sun, and there are times when we can be unaware that someone has made one for us or because of us. Tough and extraordinary circumstances will always bring extraordinary individuals to the top with their acts of selfless courage and sacrifice. History has its crazy horses, spotted tails, and buffalo calf roads. We will never forget their deeds or their sacrifices. Ordinary, everyday people also make sacrifices and remind us that it is within human nature to do so. We stand and offer our seats on the bus or the subway, or we step back to let someone ahead of us in line. We help the elderly travelers near us in line carry their bag to the ticket counter. A mom does without new clothes so she can buy them for her children. A man checks on his vacationing neighbor's house and waters and mows the lawn. These are simple acts, but they can give us all a sense of dignity and an example to follow. My cousin Israel Knife and I were deer hunting near the confluence of the Little and Big White Widder rivers in the fall of 1964. Israel was extremely shy around white folks. In fact, he would always ask me to order for him in restaurants. But by ourselves in the backcountry or anywhere white folks weren't around, he could talk my ear off. We didn't have much luck on this particular day, so we wearily trudged back to a trail where our ride, Israel's dad, would pick us up. Just west of the Little White River, we heard a commotion in some trees, a veritable tirade of cussing and shouting. Soon we found the source of the noise. Two out-of-state white hunters, who had somehow managed to entangle the antlers of a 5-point white-tailed buck in the strands of an unyielding 3-strand barbed wire fence. With the antlers caught, the dead deer wasn't going anywhere, no matter how the two hunters tried to disentangle it. In fact, they did nothing but exacerbate the situation. They were twisting the antlers tighter into the wire. Having exhausted all alternatives from their point of view, the hunter's next recourse was to cut off the head and leave it caught in the fence. As they each whipped out a bowie knife with a 12-inch blade, I suggested that a game warden might take a dim view of a headless deer carcass. Israel and I studied the puzzle of the tangled antlers. We inserted sturdy twigs at a few strategic places, untwisted the wire, and freed the antlers. The deer fell to the ground, and I swear he looked quite relieved. Then we carefully dragged the carcass under the bottom strand and turned it over to the two astonished hunters. "How did you do that?" asked one. "Why did you do that?" asked the other. "Somebody had to," replied Israel. It was the first time I ever heard him use a disgusted and at the same time amused tone of voice to a white man. They offered us money, which we declined. We walked away, and when we turned to look back, they were still staring at us, their jaws hanging open. "Money would have been nice," I said. "Yes," replied Israel, "but just think. Every time those two go deer hunting or see a deer, they're going to think about two Indian boys. Amazing what the gift of South can do." And that concludes Chapter 6.
This program is funded in part by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Thank you for listening to Ohomani Iotaka on KDKO 89.5 FM.